support not only for ITV, Channel 4 and independent local radio, but for two channels at least of direct broadcasting by satellite, a new television Channel 5, local television, three new national radio networks, some new localised radio, and as well television and radio over Europe. Few of the new ventures will be sufficiently special to lend themselves naturally to subscription or to base themselves greatly on monies from sponsorship. Advertising is the natural white knight, or is it? Government seems to assume that once advertisers get what they say they want, competition, they will handsomely increase their advertising spend. But when the key 500 companies were asked by the BBC, prior to Peacock, by how much they would increase their spend if even cost per thousand fell by as much as a third, they averaged out around 5%. No license to print money there. Hence a proper worry that the buck will stop at budgets for programmes. Indeed, add in the upfront monies that tomorrow's commercial companies will have to pay to win a contract auction, and recall too that they will still be liable to levy on profits, and you must conclude that the government intends lean times for programme making in the commercial sector. That sits ill with the White Paper's protestations about maintaining quality. Steady funding begets good programming. As the TVAM episode demonstrated, all pretensions to quality bite the dust if the bottom line frays away. The White Paper also turns aside from the fallback position advocated by Peacock of a Public Service Broadcasting Council to ensure the flow of good works when other funding fails. Small wonder that the Director of Programmes of London Weekend, quick to the life raft, fattens his catalogue of programmes expected to go to the wall, not surprisingly, religion and children first. Tory traditionalists used to leave enough money in the pot to enable broadcasters to aspire to great broadcasting. You can properly argue, from the pay scales at large in ITV, that they overdid it. But the White Paper overcompensates for previous laxity and generosity. The viewer will be among the losers. Would Granada embark on Jewel in the Crown in the face of the White Paper? One somehow doubts it. And it would be folly to expect much initially from tomorrow's newcomers. Start-up costs for satellite or cable are mountainous, leaving even less comparatively for fresh programmes. British Satellite Broadcasting's programme budget for three channels is less than that currently available either to BBC Two or Channel 4. And cable, the White Paper quietly concedes, has been slow to grow in the face of, quote, high capital costs and the absence of any significant revenue in the early years. Precisely. Yet, the overall tone of the White Paper is resiliently bullish. Open the technological cage, and the white heat of creativity and invention will apparently overwhelm you. A flavouring of traditional Tory scepticism would be welcome. Given what we know of cable's limping start, there would be something to be said for damping down the public's expectations rather than overexciting them. After all, viewers are expected to dig quite deep for new aerials, decoders, and dishes. They will be less than pleased if and when projects in which they take a stake go fut. Once some variant of the White Paper becomes law, much will be left in the hands of the ITC, the Independent Television Commission, set to replace the television functions of the IBA. How independent will it be? The White Paper adopts a hands-off stance, pointing out that it is not for government to pick winners. But should the ITC try to limit the number of losers? Does it just sit back and let everyone have a go? Or can it opt for a timetable of its own, designed to increase the likelihood of successes and minimise costly flops? That opinion there by Brian Wenham, who was once Director of Programmes at BBC Television.
This following programme dedicated to the city and people of San Francisco, who may not know it, but they are beautiful, and so is their city. This is a very personal song, so if the viewer cannot understand it, particularly those of you who are European residents, save up all your bread and fly Translove Airways to San Francisco, USA. Then maybe you'll understand the song. It will be worth it. If not for the sake of this song, but for the sake of your own peace of mind.
Strobe lights beam, create streams. Walls move, minds do too. On a warm San Franciscan night, old child, young child, feel all right. On a warm San Franciscan night, angels sing, leather wings, jeans of blue, Harley Davidson's too. On a warm San Franciscan night, old angel, young angel, feel all right. On a warm San Franciscan night, I wasn't born there, perhaps I'll die there. There's no place left to go. San Francisco. Face is filled with hate. Heavens above, he's on a street called love. When will they ever learn? Old cop, young cop, feel all right on a warm San Franciscan night. The children are cool, they don't raise fools. An American dream includes Indians too.
If you get used to listening to AM signals through a synchronous detector, you will find it quite painful if you have to go back to an envelope detector. The improvement in signal-to-noise ratio and reduction in chatter from adjacent stations is particularly helpful on weak or fading signals. We produce a complete boxed phase-lock synchronous detector, which accepts 455 kHz IF input to suit many receivers. The two audio line level outputs can be fed into a hi-fi stereo system, and the four front panel controls allow reception of double sideband, upper sideband, lower sideband, stereo spread or independent sideband with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and improves the audibility of weaker co-channel signals, and finally, a low distortion envelope detector. Apart from all this, there is also an audio level controller, which counteracts the objectionable surging in loudness as the carrier goes through a selective fade and the automatic gain control in the receiver unnecessarily increases the gain. The unit costs £150, and a detailed four-page information sheet is available if you send along 1 14-pence British stamp or 1 international reply coupon to Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. In the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society, an 18-bit digital-to-analog converter for high-performance digital audio applications by Joel M. Halbert and Mark A. Schill from the Burr Brown Corporation, Tucson, Arizona, in the United States. The design and implementation details of a new 18-bit digital-to-analog converter are presented. The device is suitable for digital audio applications requiring an unusually large dynamic range, low wideband noise, high speed, and low distortion. Key design considerations include careful management of thermal effects, a low glitch switching architecture, and isolation of parasitic noise sources. The case for converters beyond 16 bits. Since the introduction of consumer digital audio equipment at the beginning of the decade, professional audio engineers have found themselves in a new and difficult position. Through the 1970s, professional recording and mixing electronics could be designed to have measurably better performance than most consumer playback machines. Even with several generations of mixing, dubbing, equalization, and other processing, the final master tapes were usually cleaner than all but the most expensive home reproduction systems. Furthermore, the sound from top-quality playback systems was still limited by the fidelity of mass-produced LPs and cassettes. This comfortable situation was seriously challenged by the introduction of compact disc technology. First, CDs largely eliminate the quality variables associated with vinyl and analog tape media. Second, the accuracy of the analog output signal is limited only by the digital-to-analog converter, deglitcher, filter, and small signal post-amplifier. Although not perfect, the 16-bit DACs available to CD player manufacturers have extremely good performance. In many cases, better than the total signal chain used in the recording and mastering process. Designers of professional studio equipment can buy converters that are specially selected and guaranteed for linearity. But these provide only partial improvement, because the fundamental limitation of the 16-bit quantization error remains. In order to realize the full potential of audio fidelity for the end user, the signal digitization and processing steps must have a greater dynamic range than the final recording. The studio engineer is then free to equalize, expand, filter, mix, and amplify without accumulating errors higher than the 16-bit level. An ideal signal processing system would therefore be based on digital words of more than 16 bits. Modern studios use both analog and digital processing equipment. Connecting them together requires digital-to-analog and analog-to-digital conversion elements, which should also provide greater than 16-bit resolution. The basic building block of these elements is a reliable, easy-to-use and compact DAC. High-quality consumer playback equipment is also moving towards the use of 18-bit DACs, even though the source material, CD and digital audio tape, contains only 16-bit data words. At this time, the authors feel that the relative merits of such applications have not been well established. But this does not imply that there is no justification for such use. Certainly, it is advantageous to improve the linearity and reduce the thermal noise of the playback DACs, improving distortion and signal-to-noise ratio. Beyond that, the addition of 2 bits has several potential advantages, which require further investigation. It is certainly possible to recover real information below the 16-bit quantization level during periods when the signal bandwidth is considerably less than the Nyquist frequency, 20 to 22 kHz for CDs. This is because a limited bandwidth signal is effectively being oversampled by the 44.1 kHz clock, and a properly designed digital signal processor can use extra DAC resolution to best advantage. Note that this is not the same thing as the oversampling digital filters currently used in many CD players, which cannot generally extract any real information beyond 16 bits. Though the interpolation hardware used in these filters may have extra round-off bits, the significance of the resulting signal is actually less than 16 bits, leaving the total residual error roughly constant. For the widely used total harmonic distortion test frequencies below 5 kHz, a reasonably linear 18-bit DAC can produce total harmonic distortion figures in excess of minus 100 dB. Low-level, low-frequency gain tracking will also benefit from the extra dynamic range. Again, results which at first glance seem to violate the 16-bit limit are indeed feasible, assuming specific input signal characteristics. To take full advantage of 18-bit converters in a 16-bit CD or DAT player, more sophisticated signal adaptive DSP hardware will be required. Although particular specifications can be improved in this way, the subjective benefits with real musical signals are yet to be documented. It is also quite possible that the extra bits can be used to produce effects which subjectively improve the sound quality, even if the measured total error power is not reduced. The increasing market presence of players with 18-bit technology, quote, will stimulate manufacturers to maximise both measured and perceived performance. The 18-bit DAC described here is designed to provide the building block solution for demanding applications in studio equipment. The converter can also be applied to consumer equipment, providing new levels of performance along with flexibility for manual or automatic calibration. The paper then goes through the detailed design of the DAC. So if we go to the end of it, after they've presented graphical and oscilloscope photographs of the low-level linearity accuracy of the 18-bit converters, the final paragraph regarding the distortion performance. Sine wave distortion tests at approximately 1 kHz have yielded results of around 0.0008% total harmonic distortion, which again challenge the limits of the available test equipment. Since transfer function linearity can be demonstrated at the 0.002% level, the limitation on total harmonic distortion is primarily due to dynamic considerations. Great care must be used in the deglitcher design to minimise non-linear switching products and feed-through.
NTS Mobile, an article from Studio Sound. The NTS is a charitable mobile recording unit manned by volunteers that aims to make extra facilities available to hospital radio. Janet Angus visited them on a location in Portsmouth. Owners of recording studios will be the first to assure you that if you're in it for the money, you've picked the wrong business. The days when recording studios paid huge dividends were short-lived and are long gone. The same applies to mobile recording units, if not more so. The National Transcription Service is a relative newcomer to the field whose philosophy and concept is unique in the industry. Run by a diverse collection of personnel from all walks of life, it has come into being as essentially a charitable concern. The people involved all work on a voluntary basis, and their aim is to build up a tape library of recorded local events, not only music, but drama, documentaries, and anything that can incorporate a local flavour, as well as achieving some sort of longevity. David Herlock, one of the founding members of the team, explained, "The whole purpose is to build a tape library for hospital radio to use. That's no mean task, because we all know radio gobbles up tape very quickly. It takes much longer to produce 2 hours worth of documentary or whatever than it takes to broadcast. Hospital radio relies very heavily on using records, and because younger people tend to have a lot of time to spare, for example after school, it also relies on school children a lot of the time to run it. The trouble is that the majority of hospitals get a lot of people who are 60 years old plus. The things they relate to are music from the 1940s and 50s, not today's pop music, which is what the young people operating the stations relate to. 9 times out of 10, people in hospital do want to make programmes, documentaries, etc., but they just don't have the facilities or resources. By seeking sponsorship, NTS have managed to put together a very professional outfit that will now strive to fill these gaps. The personnel involved each have their own motives. Herlock was inspired in 1979 after a long stay in Chichester Hospital, after which he felt a need to give something in return for the care he had received. As a dealer in second-hand recording equipment, tape services and lighting, and a live sound operator, he has perhaps most experience of the recording industry of the NTS team. They are Ralph Harvey, formerly sleeve note writer for EMI Records, Dennis Hall, retired Plessy's employee responsible for wiring, Ray Betts, master builder, and Mr. Fixit, who turns his hand to any metal or wood repairs. Sally Peer, involved with hospital radio, Duncan Marshall, hospital radio, local radio, TVS, etc., Roderick Henley, retired Lloyds Bank Management, who brought financial expertise to the project, unfortunately temporarily, retired from NTS due to illness, and Sally Strong, who holds us all in check. When we're getting carried away with our plans, she brings us all down to earth and forces us to be realistic. We all work on a voluntary basis, but it is coming to the point where people keep asking us to record them, and we are beginning to think commercially. We should charge around £350 a day, and then that would pay for one of us full time. Back in 1984, after Herlock's stay in Chichester Hospital, he recorded the Southern Chamber Orchestra using some of his second-hand equipment stock for the hospital. In 1985, he spent 2 weeks at Chichester Festival recording various events for broadcast at the hospital. I had some STC 4038 ribbon microphones and a stereo Longdon desk, which all came out of a hall in London, was sold to somebody in the Midlands, and then came to me when it was scrapped. I had bought some telecine equipment, and the desk was thrown in. It was useless for studio work, so I couldn't sell it. It was very noisy, but had a good tone. I had 2 Studer A662s, and put the whole lot into a Luton van. When I'd finished, I was left with a pile of cables and that old desk, which has subsequently been scrapped.
Maybe I know that he's been cheating. Maybe I know that he's been untrue. But what can I do? I hear them whispering. Oh, but me.
idea of NTS developed, sponsors were gradually found. In early 1987, Herlock heard a rumour that the BBC was retiring one of its transcriptions vans and negotiated to buy it, hopefully complete with mixing desk. In the event, it arrived minus the console, which had been hurriedly removed, leaving cables cut under the floor, mains cables were snipped off and left too short to rewire, monitor speaker fascia plates were missing. Yes, I frowned a lot too, but we did get it at a very reasonable price. Even the track lighting had gone, and yet they had left things like a patch bay, complete with Varelco connectors, the air conditioning, and there's a socket in the wall that's wired via a thermostat so that you can have a heater plugged in and it will automatically switch on during a cold night to keep the van and equipment warm for you when you want to start work the next day. Citicorp Citibank came up with the money to buy the van and most of its equipment on the basis that it would be used for charitable work and that NTS would also do commercial work to enable to pay its own way. People like to give money to build something. It's always easy to get money to create something they can physically look at, but you can't get them to give money to record things. The van arrived in traditional green and grey BBC hue. Dulux Paints were persuaded to donate the paints for Sparshats, custom truck builders whose clients include the BBC, to paint it blue and white with the NTS and various sponsors' logos. Wiring was not NTS's only problem. For some unknown reason, the truck had been fitted with an exhaust pipe designed for a tipper truck, so the exhaust fumes were being drawn up inside. It was full of black diesel fumes, and the walls and ceilings were plastered. It was crazy. Every time the BBC chaps arrived anywhere, they had to dismantle the desk and clean it. We ran it for about a month until we decided we couldn't go on with it. We replaced all the Hessian inside and cleaned the woodwork, which was black, and shampooed the carpet goodness knows how many times. The finished product is now fitted with a Neve 8066 20-channel 16-track monitoring mixer and a pair of Rogers LS37 monitors. We are recording mostly live or classical music and quite often can get away with only using four channels. A lot of people go around with a Nagra and a pair of headphones. That's not really the way to do it, is it? And sitting in a room, in the hall or in the church, no matter how well you know the equipment, it's not as good as sitting in a room where you know the acoustics. The Neve came out of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, and the three B62s came from the BBC. There is a Studer A80 8-track recorder and a full complement of Dolby A-type noise reduction. Apart from the dynamic section on the mixer, there is an Alesis microverb, which tends to be left on the same setting, as well as custom BBC compressors and noise gates, which are in fact seldom needed. We have access to a second A80 should we need it. Being a BBC vehicle, we've got a lot of things like voltmeters and ampermeters and a Lyons voltage stabiliser, which means we can go down to as little as 204 volts and still get 240. Our multi-core cables are the same as the BBC's, 7 mic pairs on each one, giving a total of 56. We've all got the usual microphone splitters, etc. On the van's exterior, there is a simple but essential extra. One thing which always happens when you're recording a concert, the event finishes, the people have gone, and you are still upstairs packing your cables away when they throw you out. So you've dragged all your cables out in a mess, and then they turn the lights off outside. We've put lights on the side and on the back of the lorry, as well as over the spare wheel, and we carry two large batteries that power these, as well as the fluorescent strips inside. Two automatically switching phantom power supplies are carried in the case of failure. There is a video, a monitor in the lorry, but unfortunately the only thing we haven't got at the moment is a camera. We should be able to get hold of one, but in fact a lot of theatres have their own, which we can hook up to. Two Alpage AL300 cassette machines, ex-Stones Mobile, complete the equipment list. Back at Herlock's base, there is a woolen sack mono times 5 cassette copying machine. The cassettes are duplicated in mono, as hospital radio is broadcast in mono. Herlock has elected to use Agfa 468 multitrack tape, as he finds it less likely to have print-through problems on old tapes. In my experience, Ampex 456 gives a lot of print-through on old tape, and there seems to be a white dust which comes off it onto the tape guides and is extremely difficult to clean. With Agfa 468, I never had those problems. It also winds very easily on any machine, nice and smooth, with very little print through. Also, the writing on the tape is very useful for editing. You can see very quickly and easily if the tape has moved on before you put the razor blade on it. One of the hurdles to building up a tape library has been persuading the musicians' union to allow their members to be recorded for charity. But Herlock is confident that the situation will be resolved. Although NTS is currently concentrating on the West Sussex area, they will move on somewhere else when they have compiled a good stock of programmes. We record things like classical concerts given by local orchestras, programmes about West Sussex, things which have given quite a lot of wide appeal. Events in Chichester will be of interest to people in Worthing and Portsmouth hospitals, as well as Chichester. There is an organisation called NAHBO, the National Association of Hospital Broadcast Organisations, which offers a library of about 97 titles, which any hospital is entitled to use. All they have to do is send in an appropriate cassette and stamped addressed envelope. But it's never been that successful. For a start, 97 titles is not very much, and you soon exhaust that lot. The other reason is that people so frequently send in the wrong length cassette. They want a one-hour programme, so they send in a C60 instead of a C120, which will have to be turned over halfway through. What are they going to do when they're broadcasting while they turn the tape over? Or else they send the wrong stamp, or even forget the stamp altogether. What we do intend to do is to put our recordings on C120 tapes, which we will provide and bulk duplicate. They will be offered to the hospital radio stations for £1.10, which will include everything, postage, packing, cue list, and all the paperwork, etc. All we need now is more people to use us, both commercially and for the hospital work. We have to rely on word of mouth, but I think that's the best way.
Radio Facts will finish in December. We have been on the air for 3 months, and through that time you have been sending us over 100 letters each week telling us how much this kind of speech programming is appreciated. We also know that we have a fair number of very enthusiastic blind listeners. So, we remain a legal operation and close down in December, unless some government writes us out the licence we have been asking for since 3 years ago. What would the other possible options be? We could stay on the air from the Republic of Ireland, or we could come on the air from England. By making public the time and place, this would be a fairly straightforward act of civil disobedience, and the presumably inevitable court case would form part of the history of broadcasting. If hundreds of you write to say that is what you think we should do, then I suppose we would have to consider it seriously. But we have to make it clear now that these are not options we regard as compatible with a professional operation.
The letters you send are what has made this project worthwhile. And thank you again to everybody who's taken the trouble to write. We get letters from people aged between 17 and 70. And anyone in the media world will know that something appealing to such an age range is most unusual. Some of the historical items we have carried, the development of magnetic tape, the story of radar, old BBC transmitting stations, the inventions of magnetic recording, from wire recorders to digital tape, and others, have brought in letters from people involved in the work up to 50 years ago. If we were staying on the air, one thing we would have liked to do was to organise a contact point so that people who have worked together years and years ago could get in touch with each other again.
One thing we have achieved might be the most listened to programme per watt transmitted, and we mean listened to. Many shortwave stations are heard and logged, but your letters make it clear that people do listen to radio facts.
The use of shortwaves has fallen significantly over the last 20 years, and everyone seems agreed that, with a view to the future, what radio facts has demonstrated is now a useful and appropriate use of 9 kHz of the spectrum. What can you do? Well, if you think radio facts or something like it should be offered a licence, you could write to your Member of Parliament at the House of Commons, London SW1A OAA. And the ministers responsible are Douglas Hurd and Timothy Renton at the Home Office, Queen Anne's Gate, London SW1H 9AT.
You are the people who know it is rubbish to say that no frequencies are available. There are a greater number of you using the HF spectrum for education and recreation than all other users put together. So your voice should carry some weight in decisions about what some fraction of it is used for. To put the number of letters we get in context, it is more each week than the BBC Radio 4 Any Answers programme has been receiving recently. That's a response any radio station would be proud of. And we're pretty proud of you for providing us with this evidence in the form of the letters, which are now overflowing a very large box file. Hard of hearing, a short item from The Independent. A three-year-old with a sense of humour, of sorts, squirted some superglue into the left ear of his sleeping father. Accidental bonding with these ultra-powerful adhesives can usually be treated easily and promptly. This time, according to Dr. Hoke Pollock of Wilmington, North Carolina, the child's father did not notice until some days later. By then, the glue had hardened into a solid plug, moulded to the man's inner ear. It was painful, and the man lost his hearing. Writing in the archives of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, Dr. Pollock said that the man had to have a major operation to remove the plug, whereupon the man gradually regained his sense of hearing. Lucky fellow.